Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of South Dakota, the Honorable David Gilbertson presiding, is now open for the transaction of any business that may legally come before it.
Good morning. The first case for oral argument this morning is the State of South Dakota Appellee versus Jamie Corrine. Is that what you pronounce? All right. Appellant. For the appellant, we have Mr. David Claggett, an attorney from Spearfish. And for the state, we have Mr. Frank Geegan, an assistant attorney general from Pierre. Mr. Claggett, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
In August of 2008, Jamie Corrine was convicted of being an accessory to murder and aiding and abetting aggravated kidnapping regarding the kidnapping of Troy Klug. Troy was a resident of Rapid City. Troy had gone to a drug dealer of his, Cynthia Kendall, to get some drugs. He had been there before and he owed her money already for drugs. His plan apparently was to get more drugs, sell those, pay her off, and have some drugs of his own. He went there the afternoon of Monday, July 12th. He went there with his living girlfriend's brother, a guy named Hiley. Hiley had to leave because Cynthia Kendall did not want him in her house. So he took off, leaving Klug in with Kendall and with Tori Teagan. Now, Tori had been a recent acquaintance of Kendall's. Kendall was a rather large drug dealer in Rapid City. And Teagan wanted to get into business with her, I think. I mean, that's what it appears. And he wanted to impress her. He's a rather large, imposing person. While he was there with Klug, Kendall left ostensibly to go to an attorney's office regarding a Social Security claim. While she was gone, Teagan overpowered Klug, apparently to impress upon him the need to pay this drug debt. When Kendall came back, Klug had been subdued, and Kendall and Teagan put Klug in the trunk of Kendall's car and left the house. Again, all in Rapid City. They eventually went to Klug's house. He shared it with a woman by the name of Dwana Beebe. They were there about 9:30 that night. Left a baby's house and went to rural Butte County, right outside of Belle Fourche, to the home of Tel Cook. Tel Cook had been an acquaintance of Teagan's. As a matter of fact, throughout this process, on July 12th, while the subjugation occurred, there were four phone calls made from Teagan to Tel Cook. Apparently, he must have been making arrangements to come to Cook's house, because the last phone call was when they left Beebe's house and they headed right to Cook's house. They must have made a couple of stops, because they got to Cook's house early in the morning of Tuesday, July 13th. At that time, they showed Cook that Klug was in the trunk of the car. And apparently, there's some differing testimony, but apparently Cook and Teagan punched Klug when he was in the car. Teagan and Cook left Cook's house early in the morning of July 13th, again, Tuesday. They took him for a ride, again, apparently to scare him. I think at this point, they didn't know what to do with him anymore. But Cook voluntarily went in with Teagan on this little trip. They took him out to a road called Helmer Road. That's a gravel road between Spearfish and Belle Fourche. Let him out of the trunk and roughed him up a bit. Cook actually, according to Teagan, kicked Klug in the side of the head, beat on him pretty good. They got him back in the trunk of the car. Teagan brought Cook back to Cook's house, because then Cook went to work. Teagan then took Klug over to a house that Jamie Corrine lived in. She lived in with a guy named James Cusick, boyfriend of hers. The house sits outside of Belle Fourche. The house has a detached shop, garage. Teagan apparently informed Cusick that he wanted to put in a radar detector in his car and use the garage. Apparently, he'd used the garage before. He pulls the car in there, and according to Cusick, he shows Klug in the trunk of the car to Cusick. In the meantime, Jamie Corrine, who'd been in the house, was getting ready for work. She came out of the house, left for work before her boyfriend Cusick took off, and while Teagan was still at the house. She didn't work very far away from the house. She went to work about 10 o'clock that morning, again Tuesday morning. Cusick calls her up, asks her to go check the house, see if Teagan's still there. She does. She comes back to work, goes back for lunch, and she's back at work until 5:30, 6 o'clock that night.
Just let me interrupt you for a second, because I understand, at least from the state's point of view, there's a fact that maybe you left out, and or maybe I have forgotten the facts. But as I understand it, Cusick says that he told her that morning that Klug was in the garage.
Cusick, after 4 years and numerous times that he talked with officers and testified, had indicated that she didn't have any idea. He didn't come around to this story until approximately March of 2008, while the grand juries were going on. Now, the problem was is that there's another individual, DeYoung, Abby DeYoung, and her boyfriend, Eric Hart. As the case develops, Tuesday evening, Abby DeYoung and Eric Haar were over at the house, over at the Cusick house. Later on in that evening, Teagan and Kendall show up. At that time, Teagan apparently loads up the body of Klug. According to Teagan's testimony, and we did not have his testimony at trial because he was called right at the beginning of the trial and he took the fifth. He was looking at the death penalty. Okay. At that point, in early 2008, the state approached Abby DeYoung, who had testified several times under oath that nobody knew anything about this, including Jamie Corrine. They also approached Eric Haar, her boyfriend, same thing. They were offered a deal, and their deal was, you're not subject to any charges. Not for perjury, not as an accessory to murder, not for kidnapping, aggravated or otherwise.
And you say they, you're including Cusick, he was offered the same deal?
Cusick actually came to this agreement later than the other two. And there's a reason for that, because the state had the same type of offers, to some extent, with some penalties for Korean and Cusick. And Cusick jumped on it. He had a lot of problems. He'd been up to the panic before. Cusick jumped on it and then all of a sudden changed his story and said she knew something that day. Okay. The problem that I have with all of this is that because of their knowledge saying that they were present that day on Tuesday, the 13th of July, and that there was some discussion about a body out in the garage, they were all accomplices. They had to be. They were subject to the same penalty as Jamie Corrine by that statement. They were accomplices as a matter of law. One of the things we requested of Judge Bastian in this case was a jury instruction explaining that these are accomplices. Very important, because how do you judge accomplice testimony?
Well, he gave that instruction. He gave the instruction, including the admonition that the jury was to determine whether they were accomplices or not.
Sure. I think that left the door open for speculation, because what he said was Cusick and Kendall are, as a matter of law, accessories. You can decide if the other ones are accessories. But by the definition, they are accessories. And we are entitled to an instruction telling the jury not only are there the accessories, but you have to then flow from accessories to how you prove a case using accessories. And quite frankly, this case was proven only on the testimony of accessories. There's no independent evidence that really applied in this case. That is extremely important, because we then have Abby DeYoung with the motive, Eric Carter with a large motive because he was already on probation for two drug charges, one in Butte County, one in Lawrence County, and was subject to his penitentiary sentences on both of those. Kusick, who had already, he had been in the penitentiary for a drug charge. He'd been on probation, violated, went to the pen, came back, went back to the pen. He knew he was going to do a lot of time. But between three people, and only three people, DeYoung, Kusick, and Hart, those are the only three that said Jamie Corrine knew anything about this individual in there, in the garage. And their testimony varied a little bit. I think Kusick is the only one that said that she knew something in the morning. The problem that we have with it is the subsequent testimony we finally got from Teagan, which was extremely reliable. It explained...
Didn't the trial court find to the contrary?
That's what he found. But the problem is that the testimony of Teagan so undermines the testimony of other witnesses, particularly Cook. And Cook was a big part of the state's presentation, whether he was particularly relevant or not. He's the one that could come forward and explain some of the evidence that was presented. Part of the evidence were letters that had been admitted over objection into evidence. Letters that apparently were passed by Teagan to Cook when they were both in jail. And I think these letters were passed while they were in the Meade County Jail. In those letters, Teagan is obviously trying to convince Cook that he has disposed of Klug, that they can't find any evidence, so just keep quiet. Okay? They had nothing to do whatsoever with Korea. Nothing. But they were introduced, and they are certainly prejudicial. The other letter that is of extreme concern is State's Exhibit Number 1. That is a letter that was passed, apparently, from Teagan through the kiting system in Pennington County and picked up by law enforcement there. We have to remember what happened in Pennington County. On the 30th of September 2004, you had Cook in the Meade County Jail. He was not in Pennington County, but Meade County, supposedly for his security. He met with his attorney, and he met with law enforcement and said, you know what, I've been gathering these letters. Flushed some of them, I've destroyed some of them, but I gathered letters, and I'll get you some more. And these will help you with your case. Based on that, he was then transferred to the Pennington County Jail. And where was he placed? In the cell immediately adjacent to Teagan. Now, if you look at those, the State's Exhibits 2 and 3, those exhibits, the first one, the Red On Chopper, Exhibit Number 2, that seeks to assure Cook that Teagan knows that he's now on his side. Because apparently, before that, Teagan was really suspicious. And as a matter of fact, in the first State's Exhibit Number 1, which is the Hello Toots letter, Teagan's letter to Kendall, his girlfriend, who was also incarcerated. In that, the first page, he cautions her to be careful about the rat. He doesn't say who the rat is. Well, it's obviously got to be Cook because he's the only other person in jail. Those are the only three that have been arrested by this time.
Which letter are you talking about again?
I'm talking about State's Exhibit Number 1, the Hello Toots letter.
That's the Hello Toots, okay.
Yes. If you see on the first page, he references a rat partway down in the first paragraph. The second page is really disconcerting because it's obviously been altered. When you take a look at it, the rest of the letter is written with a pencil that has a soft tip, obviously. And then all of a sudden, when Teagan is cautioning Kendall about who she should not involve in this thing, that passage is erased. There's a new passage with a sharp pencil, according to the forensic examiner, written at a different time on a harder medium with a different pencil. And in there, it says James and Jamie, savvy. It infers that we've got to be cautious. We don't want to rile them up. Okay? Whatever you want to draw from that is a conclusion that certainly was a conclusion argued by the state at the trial. And it was of significance to the state. The problem that you have with it is obviously it was an alteration, and at that time, Cook was in the cell right next to Teagan. And at that time, Teagan no longer was considering Cook to be a rat. I think it's obvious in the jail system that Cook got his hands on that, altered it, and sent it out there. It directed all attention away from him.
Wasn't that for the jury to sort that out?
To some extent, if that evidence should not have been in there to begin with. That is one of the issues that we've got because it's a violation of the Sixth Amendment. We don't believe that it is properly under residual hearsay. It certainly isn't under the conspiracy exception, we don't believe. So one of the arguments is that was a clear error made by the judge. According to what we can see in here, there have been many errors, not just the jury instructions that we proffered, but the admission of evidence that was prejudicial. Without that evidence, first of all, without the emphasis on the accomplice testimony, and that's all it was that tied her into it. Had that been properly instructed, we don't believe that there could have been a conviction. As a matter of fact, in this case, review of the record indicates to me that Jamie Corrine is entitled to acquittal on all charges. She's entitled to the protection of double jeopardy, the double jeopardy clause, because when you review the evidence de novo, what evidence was against her? What evidence was presented to the jury that connected her to this crime? You got the testimony of three witnesses that had changed their testimony, Abby DeYoung, Eric Hart, and Cusick. That's it. There was no forensic evidence in that garage, nothing. There wasn't a drop of blood, there wasn't an eyelash, there was nothing. The job box that was used, that we found out ultimately was used, wasn't on the premises, and it wasn't discovered for probably at least a couple of months. It was at the State Highway Patrol office in Meade County. There was nothing they could find on it.
Those, the witnesses that you claim changed their testimony,
yep,
were they under oath on it each time that they testified, or was they the only time they were under oath when they testified at trial?
Abby DeYoung definitely was. Cusick was. He testified in Teagan's trial down in Rapid City. And the testimony was all about Teagan. It had nothing to do with his participation, and he didn't admit anything. We didn't find out about his participation until later on. Eric Carr had been interviewed. I don't know that he had been questioned under oath prior to that.
But you were able to cross-examine those witnesses with their prior inconsistent statements.
We did, yes. We did. And again,
there was an instruction given to the jury about that?
There was. But again, our instruction on accomplice testimony was rejected. And I think that's extremely important because, again, you look at the evidence. What other evidence is there to connect her to having any knowledge whatsoever?
So, okay, and then they were not all accomplices as far as an instruction to the jury telling them they were accomplices.
Right. The court only instructed them that Kendall and Cusick were accomplices and refused to instruct them otherwise. And under Busick, I believe paragraph 14, if in fact an accomplice, a person, meets the definition of an accomplice, that is, they're liable for exactly the same charges as a defendant is charged with, they are an accomplice as a matter of law. And what Busick indicates is then we're entitled to an instruction to that effect. As far as talking about the instructions, one that's extremely troubling is the aggravated kidnapping instruction. Now, obviously this kidnapping occurred in Rapid City, and it was a kidnapping that occurred because Klug owed money to Kendall. He didn't owe any money to anybody else but Kendall. They took him ultimately to Belfouche. There were several trips back and forth. They went to Belfouche, they went back to Rapid City, Belfouche. Over objection, the state was allowed to tell the jury by instruction that the predicate felony that you can use to find aggravated kidnapping occurred, it occurred for some reason, it had to occur for some reason. The predicate felony could have been that there were drugs at Cusick's house, that people had used drugs. It had nothing to do with the kidnapping whatsoever, remote in time, and it didn't play any part in why Klug was kidnapped to begin with. What it told the jury is, look, there was plenty of evidence that there was drug usage at the Cusick residence. It told them, hey, you can use that and you can convict this gal. And obviously, that is not a proper statement of the law. And it's an important statement because that gives you a life sentence. It's extremely important. When it comes down to, again, the evidence presented in this particular case, you can search the record, you can look at everything, but the evidence presented at trial did not establish beyond a reasonable doubt that she was an accessory to murder, nor did it establish that she had anything whatsoever to do with kidnapping or otherwise. The inference is that she knew that this guy was out in her garage. That's the inference. Okay? The question then becomes, if she did receive that knowledge, if the jury believes she received that knowledge, when did they think she received it? According to Eric Carr said, well, I didn't think she got it until that night. When you look at what actually occurred, you're looking at then the subsequent testimony of Tegan, because he was there all along. He's the one that came back at 3 o'clock on Tuesday, July 3rd, and found Klug dead.
Your time has expired, Mr. Clyde. Oh, thank you.
Excuse me. Thank you.
Mr. Gagan, you have 20 minutes, sir.
If please the court, counsel. As you know, the present appeal stems from the kidnapping and murder of Troy Klug in 2004. Many of the underlying relevant facts are set forth in State versus Tegan, which is reported at 744 Northwest 2nd, 578, where this court, on direct appeal, affirmed Tegan's conviction for kidnapping. As they pertain to defendant Korean in the present appeal, specifically her sufficiency of the evidence argument, the facts show that after kidnapping Klug, Tegan and his girlfriend, Cynthia Kendall, drove to Belfouche, South Dakota, where they went to a house owned by the defendant and her boyfriend, James Cusick. As Mr. Claggett indicated, Tegan told Cusick that he needed to use their garage because he wanted to install a radar detector in Kendall's vehicle. Once the car was inside the garage, Tegan opened the trunk, and Cusick could see that he had somebody duct-taped inside. That somebody, of course, was the victim, Troy Klug. Tegan then reached inside the trunk and, according to Cusick's testimony, pulled the victim out and just threw him on the floor. Cusick asked Tegan, and I quote, what the hell he was doing. Tegan simply responded that the victim was a snitch and a rat. He therefore proceeded to kick the victim in the stomach as he was lying on the floor of the garage. Now, there's no dispute that at that point, the victim was still alive because Cusick testified that he heard the victim moan. Cusick then went back inside the house, and he told the defendant that Tegan had somebody duct-taped out in their garage. Cusick later didn't want anything to do with it, so he grabbed his water jug and left for work. While at work, Cusick called the defendant later that morning and told her to go back to the house to make sure that Tegan was gone. He also instructed her to make sure she locked up the place. Defendant told the authorities that when she went back to the house, she did not see Tegan and that he had left by then. Cusick, on her way home from work later that afternoon, confided to a co-worker, Eric Carr, that he was afraid that perhaps Tegan left the victim at his house. He therefore asked Carr to go in and see if anybody was still inside the garage. Cusick was standing by the door when Carr opened the lid to this job box that was inside the garage, and he, Cusick, could see that somebody was stuffed inside. As soon as the defendant got home from work later that evening, Cusick told her that Tegan had left this guy here and he's still here. Cusick testified that he told the defendant at least a couple of times that the victim was outside in the job box. The defendant obviously went out to the garage and looked for herself because she later told Cusick that there really is somebody out there that she had seen. In addition to Cusick, we have other witnesses who established that the defendant did in fact know that the victim was being held in the garage. Abby Young, the defendant's best friend since high school, testified that as soon as she arrived at the house, the first thing the defendant tells her is, hey, look, there's somebody out in the garage, and he's in the toolbox. The defendant made it clear to DeYoung that the victim was being held against his will. DeYoung attempted to convince the defendant that, hey, look, we need to help this guy. We need to contact the police. What's the defendant do? She tells the defendant, no, you're not going to. According to the defendant, she was afraid that, no, the cops will get them, referring, of course, to Teagan and Kendall, who were her drug suppliers.
How many of these people that you're going through the names would you, were really conspirators in this? Or co-conspirators, I guess.
The court instructed the jury that Cusick and Kendall were, as a matter of law, accomplices. In the instruction that was given, the jury was told that as for the other witnesses, whether or not they were an accomplice was determined based on how the evidence presided.
And we don't know what the jury determined on that.
No. But even so, as the state will argue later, there was even assuming for sake of argument that there were accomplices, the state would submit that there was more than enough corroborating evidence to corroborate their testimony.
Okay, let's go. Can you?
Okay.
Can
it must
you
remember
that right now?
Right, yeah. It must remember to start with, okay, there's no need to corroborate each and every material fact the victim testified to. Excuse me, the accomplices testified to. The evidence is sufficient if it tends in some manner to connect the defendant to the commission of the crime and tends to affirm the truth of the testimony of accomplices.
Well, doesn't it come down to the timing in this case, whether he was dead before she knew about it or after?
Right, exactly. So we have the test.
What evidence is there that she would have known that he was still alive and that she would have known that?
One, like I said, her statement to Cusick, where she admitted she went out to the garage and saw that the victim was inside a toolbox.
Okay, but that came in through a co-conspirator's testimony, didn't it?
Correct.
Okay. What other evidence to corroborate the timing? I guess
Kendall,
that's what I'm looking for.
Okay, we also have Kendall, okay, the girlfriend who went out to the garage later that evening to retrieve a bag from the car. She testified that when she went out to the garage, she saw the victim lying on the floor, duct-taped. She also testified that she saw Teagan kick the victim. And at that point in time, the victim rolled over, which again establishes that the victim was still alive. The defense argument is premised on the testimony of Teagan that when he went back to the garage later that afternoon at 3 o'clock, the victim was already dead. Okay. The only problem with that is, as the trial court found, Teagan conveniently failed to mention the fact that, according to the defendant's own statement, she had gone back to the house to lock the garage. Teagan offered no explanation how he was able to get into a garage that was locked. The defendant also ignores the testimony, or excuse me, the findings of fact by the trial court, that the testimony of Cusick, Hart, and DeYoung regarding the victim's time of death was corroborated by an expert witness. Dr. Neil Haskell, an entomologist, testified that the victim died at the earliest on Wednesday, July 14th. The trial court, therefore, in its findings of fact and denying defendant's motion for new trial, specifically found that Teagan's testimony is simply not credible in light of all the evidence that was provided. The trial court specifically found that Teagan's testimony at the hearing, specifically that Jamie Corrine got a raw deal, was indicative of a bias on his part, and that he therefore had a motive in the outcome of the proceedings.
I know, but she didn't get an opportunity, however, to even present that. Isn't that part of her argument?
Teagan's testimony?
Yes.
Right. She alleges that somehow Teagan was unavailable due to the state's desire to seek the death penalty. The state, however, will submit that there's absolutely no evidence, no proof whatsoever in the record that Teagan was unavailable or that information was unavailable due to the state's desire to seek the death penalty against Teagan. Defense counsel, Mr. Claggett,
wasn't this newly discovered evidence, though? Wasn't that the argument, that it was newly discovered?
The argument was newly discovered because subsequent to her trial, Teagan ultimately decided to take an offer, a plea bargain from the state, where he confessed to murdering Clue.
But did she know, was there any evidence that he would have testified earlier on that she didn't know anything about it?
No, Teagan was called as a witness.
It had to be post-trial information that came to her.
Teagan
right?
was called as a witness at the defendant's trial, and he pled the fifth and refused to testify. Now, the state certainly can't be held at fault for the defendant's decision to plead the fifth. The state could only offer him a chance at a plea bargain. It couldn't force him to take it. The only reason his testimony was provided to Teagan, to defendant Corrine, after trial is because that's when Tegan ultimately changes his mind and decides to take the state's plea offer.
So the trial court determined that it wasn't credible?
Exactly.
And did the trial court also determine then that there was no prejudice by not having that? Or?
As part of the finding, in order to grant a motion for new trial, the defendant must show that the evidence was material and not used merely for impeachment purposes, and that the evidence probably would have changed the outcome of the proceedings, i.e. producing the quote. Here, the court found, and I quote, none of the so-called impeachment evidence or any other evidence presented by Tegan impacted the court issue in this matter. The knowledge and participation of the defendant in the kidnapping and murder of Troy Kluge. With regard to the defendant's involvement in the kidnapping, the court specifically found that shortly after, and I quote, shortly after Tegan and Kendall arrived at the defendant's home, the defendant was clearly aware that Kluge had been kidnapped by them and was being held against his will. The defendant knew that Troy Kluge was bound and gagged in the toolbox at her residence. The defendant knowingly joined, participated, and perpetuated the kidnapping, providing her residence as a sanctuary, a safe haven for their use, while Kluge remained on her property.
And the trial court made that determination.
Correct. I've just quoted the trial court's findings of fact and denying the motion for a new trial.
Would you address the argument counsel made about the predicate felony for the kidnapping?
Specifically, I believe the jury instruction was instruction number 31, dealing with aiding and abetting. In the paragraph 2, specifically the court refers to possession of a controlled substance and maintaining a place for the sale of a controlled substance when referring or talking about the underlying felony. Defendant maintains that the underlying felony must be the felony for which Tegan committed the kidnapping. As Mr. Claggett argues, the evidence showed that Troy Kluge, the victim, was kidnapped because he owed Cynthia Kendall money for a prior drug debt. Problem is, the record shows that the drug sales were not limited to just Rapid City. Evidence was presented that Tegan also supplied methamphetamines to the defendant in Cusick. In fact, testimony was presented that the defendant in Cusick bought all sorts of drugs from Tegan. This was therefore not the first time that Tegan had been at the defendant's house. Witnesses had testified that they had seen him there several times before. The defendant's house was described as a so-called meeting place for drug users. The state must admit that explains then why Tegan, in order to dispose of the victim and the victim's body, opted to stop at the defendant's house. He knew, based on the past history, that he could trust the defendant not to go to the police. In fact, testimony was presented that the defendant accused it never contacted the police because they were, quote, more concerned about their drug house than they were with the victim. The defendant not only wanted to protect the drug dealer, she wanted to protect Tegan as a source for drugs. The other issue that I'd like to briefly touch on.
What about the Rapid City house? Was that a drug house that was being protected here? And was that house, was Kendall's house, was that shared with Tegan?
Yes, I believe so. When Troy Kluge, the victim, showed up at Kendall's house on the afternoon in question to purchase drugs, as Mr. Clagg indicated, apparently his intent was to purchase the drugs, sell the drugs at a profit, and then pay off Kendall. It was Tegan who answered the door. And there's evidence in the record that Tegan and Kendall were sharing the house. The other issue still I'd like to briefly address here today is in reference to the letters written by Tegan while he was in jail. Those letters were introduced pursuant to SDCL 19-16-3, subparagraph 5, which provide that a statement is not hearsay if it is offered against a party and is the statement of a co-conspirator made during and in furtherance of the conspiracy. In admitting the testimony, the trial court found that the statement only showed that there's a reasonable basis for concluding that the statement was made in furtherance of the conspiracy. That ruling, as with the other evidential rulings by trial court, is presumed to be correct. It's reviewed under clear erroneous standard. Now, here, the trial court had no difficulty finding that a conspiracy existed. In its memorandum decision dated July 8, 2008, the court specifically found, as factually outlined by the Supreme Court in Tegan, and as shown by the evidence at the motion hearing herein, There is substantial evidence of a conspiracy to kidnap and murder Troy Klug. The trial court found there was no question that the letters were written while the conspiracy was continuing and constituted a step in furtherance of the conspiracy. As found by the court, efforts at concealment furthered the conspiracy by allowing the co-conspirators to escape punishment. The crux of the defendant's argument appears to be that while there was a conspiracy between Tegan and Kendall and everybody else, she, for whatever reason, was the only one who wasn't a part member of the conspiracy. The trial court however found that there was ample evidence based on the testimony of Cusick, Hart, and DeYoung, as well as Agent Romer, that a conspiracy existed between Tegan and all the others. There was no doubt whatsoever in the trial court's mind that the defendant was part of the conspiracy to kidnap and murder Troy Klug. As found by the trial court, the state may only prove by preponderance of the evidence that a conspiracy existed. Once the conspiracy was shown to exist, only slight additional evidence was needed to connect the defendant with that conspiracy. The evidence is said to be sufficient even if it shows that the defendant only played a minor role. Now, while mere presence at the scene isn't enough, any conduct, however slight, facilitating the commission of the crime renders her an accomplice. The state would submit that the defendant, when she rejected Abbott Young and Eric Hart's pleas to help the victim, to contact the police and say, no, you're not going to, we need to protect Tegan and Kendall so the cops don't get there, was sufficient to render her an accomplice.
How? I mean, did she have an affirmative duty to assist in contacting the police?
I believe so. Once she knew the victim's out there, her direct actions preventing or instructing the young and hard not to contact the police were sufficient. In addition, the evidence also suggests that she went further, that she helped Tegan clean out the toolbox, conceal the evidence once the victim was dead. Testimony was presented that the defendant was the only one who knew where the citrus cleaner was at. Finally, in an attempt to conceal the defendant's Tegan's involvement in the kidnapping, the defendant deliberately lied to the police when she was interviewed. She was specifically questioned and asked about the vehicle that Kendall and Tegan were driving. And she lied to the police and told them that they were driving a red pickup. The statement was submitted boils down to sufficient evidence question. Credibility was a question for the jury to resolve. And here, obviously, they found the evidence was sufficient to convict the defendant.
Is there an issue of when the conspiracy ended? If it ended in arrest, or are you saying there was no end to the conspiracy?
Well, the state's argument is, okay, the conspiracy doesn't end with the commission of Van Dyne overt act, i.e. the kidnapping. The kidnapping includes not only the substantive felony, okay, but also includes any attempts or acts aimed at or directed at concealing the crime. The state would submit that once the conspiracy was shown to exist, the burden was on the defense to show when it ended. Now, unless there's any further questions from the court, the state will be closed by simply asking that the defendant's conviction and sentence be affirmed in all respects.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Geegan. Mr. Claggett, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you. I'd like to address a few matters that just came up. One is there was a reference to a vehicle that was being driven by Kendall and Tegan, and I had briefed that. That was an argument that Agent Gromer attempted to make. And what he said is he interviewed Korean a couple months after all this occurred. And in the interview, recorded, she said they were driving a black car. And every time she'd ever been interviewed, they were driving a black car. He then said, we stepped outside after it was done, had a cigarette. While we're sitting out there, she tells me that he's got a red pickup. And he said, that misled me. And that's completely beyond my scope of comprehension, because they had both the black car and the pickup in their custody, in their evidence, within a week after all this occurred. I can't grasp how that somehow was her trying to hide something, especially when she had consistently said they were driving this black car. And everybody else said the same thing. Really, I didn't follow that argument. One of several arguments that have been thrown out at the time of the trial. Going to that conspiracy issue on that, again, we briefed that as well, but the state has to prove a substantial, some substantial evidence that a conspiracy existed between Korean and, well, in this case, Teagan. And according to Teagan, there was never even a conversation between the two. There's no agreement. There's nothing like this. The evidence, those letters that they put in there, were letters that were provided to the state at the end of September 2004. All of this occurred July. If, in fact, there had been some kind of a conspiracy, and again, there wasn't any kind of an agreement of any type, but if there had been some kind of conspiracy, it was long over. You had Teagan, you had Kendall, they were both arrested around July 20th up in North Dakota. You got Cook arrested around August 4th. And they're all sitting in jail. All these letters could do would be to prejudice Korean in her defense. And
remind me how those letters came in and what instructions the trial court made when they came in.
The judge brought those in under 1916-35 as residual hearsay. Certainly, if you're going to do residual hearsay, you have to take into account the Confrontation Clause of the Sixth Amendment in Article 6, Section 7 of the South Dakota Constitution. And the Constitution controls. When it comes down to using a statute to override a constitutional right, and where we consider this to be a right of confrontation, a serious right that my client had to protect herself against improper evidence, judge came to the conclusion that somehow she was involved. There was substantial evidence of a conspiracy, even though those two letters, the chopper letters, never mentioned her, had nothing to do with her, didn't discuss her. As a matter of fact, they're not reliable, and that's one of the conditions that you have for admission. They aren't reliable because we know what the facts are now. In that case, he was discussing grinding up the body, cutting it up, nastiest thing he ever did. And when he led law enforcement to the body, none of that had occurred. All they did was put the body away. One of the things that I really want to get back to on Teagan and why his evidence is so compelling, it's not merely impeaching, it's not merely cumulative, it directly attacks in a serious manner the testimony of key witnesses that the state presented. And one of those is Tel Cook. As you will see, as you see in the briefs, Tel Cook was up to this to his ears, according to Teagan. And Teagan was reluctant to testify about Tel Cook. But even with that, he said, this is what happened. Not only did Cook punch Klug a couple of times, once at his house, once later on the Helmer Road, but also at 3 o'clock, when Teagan discovered that Klug was dead, he went back to Cook's residence, talked to Cook and Kendall, and said, he's dead, we've got to go to law enforcement. We've got to turn ourselves in. They both talked him out of it, and not only did they talk him out of it, Cook told him, you got to get rid of this body, you can take it to Montana. Because he knew that there was a ranch that Teagan's family owned out there. You got to dispose of the body. When Cook was sitting up on the stand, however, the jury heard none of this. They didn't hear any of this because Teagan had state charges over his head. He didn't have any kind of an agreement. There was no incentive whatsoever for him to come and tell the truth. Because if he got up there and started telling the truth, he was convicting himself of the charges that he was trying to avoid the death penalty on. So it doesn't make any sense that we should not be allowed, as a matter of presenting a fair trial and giving Korean due process, we should, at a minimum, be allowed to have Teagan in there because his testimony impacts certainly the testimony of Kendall. Kendall's testimony was kind of weak. She's schizophrenic. She's got head injuries. She's got medical problems. She was in Yankton for a year and a half. She's got real problems, and she testified that her memory is bad. In spite of all of that, the judge improperly, in his findings, indicated that her testimony was more trustworthy than Teagan's, when Teagan really didn't have anything to lose by telling the truth. Whether or not he believes that there's a bias, witnesses all have some kind of a bias. It's rare that they don't. But his bias was apparently to say there's been an injustice here, and I want to tell the truth. And the truth he told impacts not just the testimony from Cook, which is significant, but also Cusick. In this, Cusick had a real incentive. Obviously, later on, he had an incentive because he didn't want to go for a long stretch, a life stretch in the penitentiary. But during this process, Cusick was willing to clean out the job box, to dispose of it, to bring it back to the Highway Patrol office. He's the one that did all of the work. There was no any indication anywhere that Korean, if she knew about this, if she knew something was out there, that she participated in that. And according to Tegan's testimony, a lot of what Cusick said was untrue. That's testimony that this jury should have heard, that this jury can hear, so they can judge whether or not he's telling the truth.
But isn't there some issue on finality in a case where you've got a bunch of co-conspirators? Some of them are, you know, that, I mean, isn't this sort of typical that they kind of wait to see what's going to happen to one that actually goes to trial, and then when they find out that they're convicted, the rest of them take a deal and go for it? Where would it ever end then when you've got co-conspirators and you're trying a case as an, you know, someone that's a conspirator or part of the... Wouldn't they always then almost get a new trial, because now the co-conspirator who took the fifth originally has offered a deal, and he's going to come back and say, well, nobody else, I've taken this deal, I've gotten this deal now, and I know what my sentence is, then I'm going to come back and change it and exonerate everybody else. I mean, isn't there some kind of...
This is a rare case, and we do have some of that protection, and that protection requires, among other things, substantial evidence of a conspiracy. We don't have that in this case. It also requires an ongoing conspiracy. We don't have that in this case. We have no connection whatsoever between Korean and Tegan after July 15th of that year. Nothing. And quite frankly, if she was involved in some conspiracy, she would have been more actively involved in making sure that she wasn't being dragged into anything. She wasn't. Quite frankly, she cooperated. She was interviewed. She didn't try to hide. She didn't try to conceal herself. And quite frankly, I'm trying to figure out what this conspiracy actually was that would involve her. It certainly wasn't the conspiracy to first kidnap Klug. It wasn't the conspiracy to try to get Klug to pay a drug debt. She didn't have anything at all to do that. The only thing we've got is we've got witnesses that all took a deal, that were all accessories, saying, okay, she knew at some time about this body out there. And quite frankly, none of those witnesses' testimony is corroborated. We talked just briefly about this entomologist. The entomologist Haskell was simply told by the state that the death occurred no earlier than Wednesday, when it occurred on Tuesday. Wednesday was the 14th.
And this entomologist examined the body, what, a year later or 2 years?
He didn't examine the body. He was examining the maggots that they found. Okay. Okay. And the maggots were in the trunk of the car. They were killed at some time because someone threw bleach on them, and they had to speculate as to when they were killed. And then he tried to extrapolate back based on the life of a fly. And quite frankly, we have direct evidence that says otherwise. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Clay. Court will be in recess for 10 minutes.